This is Mame Warren. Today is the 19th of June, 1996. I'm in Lexington, Virginia with James Ferrer, Jr. Now, your family goes way back at this place. I think it's really interesting. There are a lot of families that go way back. What is it about this place that is a generational thing?
I don't know. That really is a good question. Ours, in fact, doesn't go back as far as lots of families. If you wanted to date it to my great-grandfather's delivering the baccalaureate address in June of 1911. But I've talked to a lot of folks, and I suspect you have too, whose families go back even further. It's really only three generations for our family, but there are many families who go back all the way, you can trace it all the way back to Augusta Academy, and that really blows your mind. My guess is that a lot of that has to do it might be as much a Southern tradition as anything else. But I'm not sure that is the sectional thing is altogether it. I suspect that it has much more to do with the culture of the institution, particularly here, when it was vaulted into more or less national visibility by Lee's, as a result of Lee's presidency. Because, of course, prior to that, we really weren't. It was a nice, comfortable Southern academy for gentlemen from the South. And then Lee changed that dramatically. But I don't know. I don't think there's any set answer. It is interesting to note, though, that as families become more spread out across the country, and you still see that continuity throughout the generations. That's when it really gets interesting to me. It's one thing if the family is from Virginia or Maryland, and you've got three or four generations. That's relatively easy. There's a proximity, but when you get some of these families as they are today, all over the country, and you still got three and four and five generations. That's more significant, I think. And I think that speaks to, as much as anything, to the culture of the institution.
Well, so often you hear about these children. I've been hearing these people who came here as children. It was a given in their lives. Mm-hmm. Was that true for you?
No, it really wasn't. I'm not sure that my father, didn't know better, ultimately what was going to happen. But for my brother and me, it was not a foregone conclusion that we would come. He very much encouraged us to look at other schools and to make sure that if we did want to come to WNL, it was for the right reason, and not just because it was safe and easy. So my brother and I both looked around. I don't think we didn't conduct our searches as I'm not sure that a lot of students did back in the 60s or early 70s, but compared to today, at least, the way they do this college search today, it's a different scene out there now than it was 25 years ago. We did look around, and I think we both knew that we wanted a smaller institution, smaller than a UVA, UNC type of thing, although we had a number of friends going to all those schools. But finally, it just was much more comfortable for us to be here. It just was much more natural. So he really did encourage us to look, and we did a little bit of that, but I'm not so sure that your folks, my folks in that case, didn't know exactly what was going to happen at that point, and just kind of let it happen.
Now, I'm jumping ahead, and it's my fault, not yours. Let's step back Now, your grandfather went here.
Right.
Did he stay on and continue working here, or was your father the first person to work here?
No, my father was the first one. My grandfather's class of 1914. And I'm not sure how he got here. I'm really not sure. I suspect that his father had a great deal of influence on the decision. My father, I'm trying to get the chronology right. I'm not sure. My father graduated from Choate in the late 1930s. I don't recall the date. But he graduated from Choate, and then he immediately went into the Marines. This was obviously right around World War II time, so he was class of 40 maybe or something like that at Choate, and did what everybody else in the world did and went into the military. He came out at the end of the war, and I think he spent a summer at Yale and then matriculated at W&L. He finished W&L in 49, and while at W&L, he and a bunch of his buddies from the Delt House, I guess, and every other house on campus had gone into the post office and had re-enlisted in the reserves, that being the patriotic thing to do. And he then went on to Columbia Graduate School and was in the English program there. And he didn't finish that program because Korea broke out, and he was recalled. He went down to Cherry Point. He was a sergeant in the Marines in World War II and was in the Pacific Theater. And so he went back down to Cherry Point. And it was then that Frank Gillum called him and said, I want you to come when you're finished doing what you're doing with the Marines, whenever that stint finishes. He didn't go to Korea. He was stationed there, I guess, at Cherry Point for I don't know how long. But Frank Gillum said, basically, when you're finished, I want you to come work at Washington and Lee. My father had plans to finish his master's degree in English and then to go on and back into New England or whatever, wherever, and teach and coach in secondary schools. He wanted to go head into teaching and secondary school work. And Frank Gillum knew that. So he picked him up before he got finished that program and said, come and teach English at W&L.
Even without a master's.
Right. It was much easier to do in those days. Plus, he wanted to get him into the administration. And he worked in the Dean of Students office. And eventually, I guess, moved away from that and moved into admissions work and became Frank Gillum's understudy, assistant admissions director. And then when Frank Gillum retired, I'm not sure of the year, it would have been in the early 60s probably, became admissions director. So that is essentially the way it went for our family. And my father was back here in 1950, and I was born in 52. I guess, as they say, the rest is history, whatever that means.
Now, where did your family live?
The earliest recollections that I have, and they're probably induced by home movies, are of the faculty apartments on the corner of Washington Street. And I forget the name of the other street. It's the right there, where it's the cinder block bunker-looking building that's behind what is now the KA house.
At Lewis Street?
I guess it is Lewis, corner of Washington and Lewis. Right there, sort of catty corner from the police station. Mm-hmm. And we were in there with the Cooks, Jay and Flossie Cook, because the home movies show us with Gary and Trippy Cook, Jay and Flossie's kids. And I can't remember who else lived in there, but of course there was, as is today, the normal flow of temporary part-time faculty and people like that through there, or permanent who are waiting to build or buy a house, that kind of thing, the transient faculty. So we were there probably for a year or so while we were building a house, and then after that my folks built a house out on what is now Paxton Street. At that point, it was really at the farthest reaches of town. On the west side of town, and now borders the number 5 fairway on the golf course. But back then it was the Johnston Farm, and those are the only two places I think we lived when I was alive. My folks prior to that lived in the prefabs, in the war housing there in Davidson Park. And again, it was really for a matter of months or maybe a year or so. I don't recall the length of time.
Do you know whether any pictures survive of that time?
There may be. I can remember them vividly. I remember being in them as a child, going in and visiting people.
I'll have to think about who would have pictures.
Yeah, I got to think Frank Parsons, maybe Sis Davis might, because I think she and Pax Davis lived. I think they might have lived in there. I'm not positive about that, but I wonder if somebody like John Jennings might have some of that stuff. Of course, Frank is he may have exhausted his resources there, but they were long green. The one, just the single one. Have you ever seen any pictures of them? They were long green multi-unit things that were end to end, like putting the Monopoly hotels end to end and stringing those out. And then I've forgotten how many rooms there were. I have a recollection of a child coming down. Maybe it was the Youngbloods or the Colvins. Milton Colvin might have some photos of that. Bob Youngblood. I can't remember who might have been before Bob Youngblood's time. Probably was. I'm pretty sure it might have been Milton Colvin. I'm not sure if there were upstairs to this thing, but I have a recollection of a child coming down a flight of stairs in one of those things. But at any rate, they were not very fancy. They were basically one room deep, and I guess you could go from a living room to a dining room. It must have been some kind of upstairs thing, bedroom or something.
So all of this is gone, and what's in Davidson Park mm-hmm. now has replaced this.
Yeah, the fraternities. Yeah, because as a child growing up, one of my good friends was a guy named Bruce Ritz, who was Professor Ritz's son, law professor. He's now retired. Actually, I think he's deceased now. I have to check on that. But at any rate, this is Bruce Ritz, who I went through school with. He lived right next to the SAE house on Washington Street. What is now the Outing Club, I think, used to be Bruce Ritz's house. And I can remember vividly the old prefabs were still in the behind the SAE house and those houses there, the Pi Phi house. On that, it's on the site where they hold these Friday Alive things, and then the fraternity houses up there, the Sigma Chi and Spi house, and that sloping hill were all prefabs.
Do you have any idea when they were torn down?
Probably, I'm gonna guess in the. I'm just guessing, in maybe the late 60s, mid-60s, mid to late 60s. I don't recall them when I was a student here.
Do you remember the construction of those fraternity houses?
Of the Spee House and
the houses, course, that are out there now.
Well, those are just recent. Those are like 3 or 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, they were gone. I'm gonna guess mid to late '60s.
So all that land was idle, was empty,
mm-hmm,
for that many years.
Mm-hmm.
No wonder I don't remember the fraternity houses.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. Those new brick structures are really a result of the campaign and the Fraternity Renaissance program. And they're really the three of them up there now. Of course, the KAs, or rather the Kappa Sigs, and this is, you know, they got the KAs across the street, and the Kappa Sig, and then I forget which comes next, the Sigma Chi and the Spee House. But they're right there. And then as that slope continues down towards that parking lot behind the Tommy Baker's real estate company, and across the street from the tourist center. All that used to be just rows of these prefabs. And Bruce, because I remember Bruce Ritz and I used to run around, you know, back there and all that area. Hang out. He had a clubhouse right there behind his house, literally right up against the SAE property. And he used to get all their old Playboys and things like that. He had a great, you know, classic kid clubhouse. I thought it was so cool to grow up right next to a fraternity house. All these things that he would pilfer from the fraternity, from the trash cans, and all this stuff.
Oh, tell me more about that. That's great. That's great.
I mean, it's a classic kid situation. I mean, so many kids had that same experience. Bruce just happened to have this neat clubhouse in the back. It was an old shed. It looked like he and his dad or somebody had gone in there and tinkered around with. But it was all the stuff that was absolutely forbidden for young kids to have and to see and do. And that's where so much of the education, of the young adolescents comes, is by that sort of discovery process amongst themselves. And in a college town, it comes more quickly for a lot of kids than it does in other places. Because we used to hang out with a lot of these guys. I mean, some of the guys that I can remember very well, like Tersh Baker, just a big old guy from Texas who played football at W&L. And he'd wear cowboy boots with his shorts and all those things we thought were absolutely scandalous and kind of neat. You thought it was just the coolest thing in the world to be a college kid. And I'm not sure that we ever really made pests out of ourselves. I didn't hang around in the dorms as much as maybe some other kids did, but we used to hang around with guys. There's a guy named Bobby Munson was one of them. Bobby Payne, who's now a federal judge in Richmond. Bobby Munson's deceased. Bobby Payne, the Andrews, Tom Andrews is now a banker out in Seattle, and can't remember his brother's name, but the Andrews brothers were from Baltimore, and they wrestled and played lacrosse. And Jamie Andrews is the other one. Jamie played football. And these are guys who worked in the local public school system as PE instructors on a kind of a volunteer basis. And all the young guys in town just, put them up on a pedestal. These were the coolest guys in the world. Bobby Munson wrestled for W&L. Bobby Payne was a little All-American football player. He's one of the best W&L had during those 60s, during the McLaughlin era. Jamie Andrews, Tom Andrews, and there are others. I'm remembering right now only those guys.
Tell me about what these students would do in the school. How would that interaction happen?
Well, they, you know, it was, I don't know exactly how it happened that they were there. The school board, I guess, or the school put out a call to W&L and said, we'd like some, you know, we don't have a PE instructor. We would like some volunteer help. And they would find, you know, these guys who are willing, like today, so many kids are willing to give time to RARO and coach teams. Now they're professional people in the school system to do the PE thing. But that sort of sharing still goes on through the RARO, the Rockbridge Area Recreational Organization, and the literally scores of W&L students, and VMI to some extent, but mainly W&L students who have the time in the afternoons to go and coach Little League teams. And so these guys would go over to the elementary schools and do the PE thing. And it was just great. And they knew who some of us W&L types were, because they knew my father, for example, and so it was easy for us to have that kind of relationship. And then, subsequently, that's when we would, you know, when we would go to athletic events and those things, we'd watch them compete. And then as we got a little older and had the run of the town in the afternoons, you end up, you know, stopping by their house in town and hanging out for a little bit.
Meaning their fraternity house?
No. They're, you know, if they had, well, the fraternity houses to some degree, but mainly their private houses. Like the house that Seal and Frank West Settle, Frank Settle and Seal West Settle, lived in on the corner of Jefferson and I think McDowell. That used to be a private, that used to be student apartments. And Logie Bullitt, I guess, well, maybe not Logie, but Tersh Baker, and a lot of these, you know, hardcore, you know, beer drinking, football playing types would hang out there, live there, and you know, I can occasionally we'd go through and, you know, and just mess around. There's no perfectly innocent, you know, and it's come on in, you know, and what are you kids doing? And you know, and just hang out for a little while, and we thought it was really neat to be in a college guy's apartment, and you had a lot of. I can remember where. Oh, Bill David was a wide receiver for W&L back in the 60s. I can't remember when he graduated, but. He was from California, and Bill had, I think, I'm not sure if he had them simultaneously, but he had, at one point he had a motorcycle, and I can remember he gave me a ride back to the gym one day from the football field after a football game on the back of this big motorcycle. And of course, put my mother in apoplectic that I would get on a motorcycle, much less with a college student, you know, so that was a big deal. And then he had a car, Corvette, a silver Corvette, that in black paint or else black tape, something on the back said, "The Silver Bitch." And I can remember one day we pulled to the stoplight. It's so innocent now. I mean, you know, nobody would think of a car named the Silver Bitch. It would be kind of like a big deal. But back in the early 60s, mid-60s, it was a pretty big deal. And we were parked, we came to a stoplight right in front of Lexington Presbyterian Church. And we were behind Bill David in the Silver Bitch. And my mother looked at that car and said something like, "Jim, what are you going to do about that? You know, this guy, hell-raising Californian here in sleepy little Lexington with his Silver Bitch." And that was just a, you know, we were, I can remember peering over the back seat, looking at this thing, and thinking, God, that's just the coolest thing in the world. And here's my mother, who's just ticked off that somebody would have, a W&L student would have a car in a Silver Bitch. It's pretty hilarious. Now you wouldn't even blink at it. You'd just say, thank God it's only the Silver Bitch, you know, compared to what else you might have on there.
That's great. I could picture the whole scene.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is stuff right out of... That's why the show, The Wonder Years, Have you ever seen that show?
Yes, I had to stop watching it because I identified with it too much.
Well, that's like Bruce Ritz in the Clubhouse and Bill David in the Silver Bitch, you know, it's stuff like that. Those are episodes out of the Wonder Years. And we really did live a lot of that kind of stuff, you know, right here in Lexington during the 50s and 60s. It was pretty much fun.
You made a reference to the McLaughlin years. Am I correct in assuming that you would have gone to a lot of sports events?
Oh, God. My father was a huge sports nut. And my brother and I, you know, shared that enthusiasm. And, he took us to everything. I mean, we went to everything. Literally, everything that he could get us out of the house to, we would go to. All the wrestling matches and the basketball games and Doremus, and just like there is today, like my kids and Kevin O'Connell and all of the, you know, the WNL faculty and staff brats running around, you know, over in Warner Center, we did the same thing. Boyd Williamson, Chuck Williams, and Buck Leslie, who's Buck Leslie's son, Bucky, and Marshall Washburn and Doug Chase wasn't faculty, but Doug was always around. Gary and Trippy Cook, and the list goes on and on. But we'd go to all those things and watch the students, you know, and Doremus sit on the balcony on the track above the basketball court there and conveniently drop shoes on the, you know, on the other team sitting beneath them, you know, those kinds of things. And it was just a blast. We'd go down to the gym on Saturdays and my dad would be playing handball with Murph or some of the guys, and we'd be in the wrestling room or something, you know, that kind of thing. It was just a great, great place for a kid to grow up. And of course, Lee McLaughlin, you mentioned, was part of that. His dad came, they came to Lexington in the late 50s. All this is documented elsewhere, of course. I just can't remember the date. But he was the head football coach at the Episcopal High School in Alexandria and had some fabulous teams up there, and came down after the cheating scandal of 54. Boyd Williams was an insurance agent and he volunteered for a couple of years, and then they hired Lee McLaughlin and Lee came, and then they were off and running. They had a few years gearing up, and then they had these incredible teams of the 60s, the small college championship teams. And that's one way that I got to know a lot of these guys, and know who they were, the Bobby Paynes and those guys, Barton Dick, of course, who's here in town, and a lot of those guys. And I really can't speak. I can speak I knew Nubby, knew Lee very well, went to camp, went to his summer camp and all that kind of, grew up with young Lee. We're 2 months apart in age. And that's a terrific chapter in WNL's history, period. Not just sports history, but within the culture and fabric of the institution, those McLaughlin years meant more than just good football teams, because of the type of guy Lee McLaughlin was and the kind of influence he had on the people like Bobby Payne and Courtney Mosey and Barton Dick and Terry Fose and, you know, all of those, Charlie Gummy and, you know, and all of these great players from the 60s. So that was a pretty significant time. And then he died in 68 or 69.
Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah. That, well, it's frightening how much Gary Fallon's experience paralleled Lee McLaughlin's. It really is. I mean, there probably is something to astrology, you know, if you want to look at it that way, because I don't know how else to account for it. But Lee McLaughlin's influence was profound, and then Lee died in that tragic accident that he was electrocuted out of his summer camp. And that was it. I mean, that was the end of the McLaughlin era. And then there were others who came in and who, you know, the football program specifically floundered for a few years until they were able to hire Gary Fallon. And Gary came down, again, I can't recall all the, probably in the late 70s, probably 77 or 78, somewhere in that neighborhood. Or maybe even a couple of years later. But at any rate, Gary, you know, his legacy is well known across the institution for that decade of the 80s and early 90s, and the impact that he had on kids. He had an influence on some of these guys from the decades of the 80s and the early 90s in a similar fashion to what McLaughlin had on the W&L guys in the late 50s and 60s. And of course, Gary's death was a tragic, untimely, you know, how do you account for it kind of thing.
Okay, we're talking to posterity here. Tell us what happened to Gary Fallon.
Well, Gary, I played golf with him a couple of days before, and literally on the day he died, I remember passing him on the street, waving, and then the next thing I knew, on Sunday, we were getting news that he had died in his sleep. There wasn't an autopsy, but the assumption is after they checked it all out, it appears that he died in his sleep of a heart attack. Just that simple. Gary Fallon, we used to occasionally bump into each other like at 5:30, 6 in the morning down in the weight room. And I'm here to tell you, I mean, anybody who knew Gary knew that this guy was chiseled out of that cinder block wall. Gary Fallon was just in incredible shape. And, you know, then he dies in the sleep of a heart attack. And it's one of those things you just don't. And unfortunately, I say unfortunately because it would kind of, you know, I've wondered whether or not there might have been a congenital kind of thing that nobody had ever picked up before, you know, that would account for it, or whether he just flat had a heart attack. You know, how do you figure it? So I think the Fallon and McLaughlin eras are, I mean, it's scary to me how, you know, the untimely death, you know, they're both very young, had been very successful, had a lot of influence on the young people that they worked with. And it, you know, it was just a killer. So, but Lee McLaughlin was great. And Gary was too. I mean, they're both great, great guys, a lot of fun to be with, great practical jokers, you know, just really, really neat people.
What do you mean, practical jokers?
Kind of they love doing stuff, pulling jokes on guys. I'm not going to be able to come up with a lot of specifics, but Lee McLaughlin was notorious for that kind of thing, the practical jokes that he would pull on people. He loved doing that kind of stuff. Absolutely reveled in it. And Gary was a lot the same way. That's probably not. I mean, if you look at people in that profession, you know, working with young people and coaching, you know, there is that sort of childlike element to them, you know, because after all, they're working with young people in games, and it's supposed to be fun, and they had a way of, while they would put a lot of pressure on themselves, they could let a lot of it off through, you know, just good-natured practical jokes. And, you know, they were wise in... Lee McLaughlin was a very, very strong Christian. And I can remember his being in his home when they would... maybe this would be late in the evening or something on a Sunday before dinner, and he would get his family together, and he'd read some from the Bible, and you know, and would have kind of a mini devotion period, and he would always do that at his summer camp. There was a morning session every morning, devotions, which was about a 15-minute period when he'd read a passage, and it'd be a little lesson to it, and then. And then there'd be announcements, and you'd go on about your daily activity. So that element was very, very prevalent with Lee McLaughlin. He never let that get in the way of a good joke, you know, or having a good time. But he was, that's just the way he was. He had that, that was important to him. And I can't speak to that about Gary, but I suspect in his own way, you know, it was important, but... they were both sort of wise and, you know, in the, just the way of life, just the way that they worked with young people and the influence they had on their lives, and just gave good advice, you know, and the guys that they worked with, you know, really bought into it.
I've been going through, one day a couple of weeks ago, I went through the photographs over in the sports information office, and I found a picture that I just loved of a wrestling match. And here you have these two guys in the foreground really going at it, doing their wrestling. And in the background are all these people down there, and they're really cheering, and they're all wearing their coats and ties. And I just love that. You know, it so spoke to a time.
Boy, it puts the period in framework there. I mean, it really tells you when it was, doesn't it?
Was that just a given around here?
Yeah. And I suspect it was in lots of other places too, although I don't have that personal experience. But I suspect if, you know, let's say that photo was from the late 50s or early 60s, you could go over to Charlottesville or maybe Princeton or Davidson, and you'd see this, you know, you'd probably see a very similar scene. So I think it reflects as much as anything just what was going on everywhere. But it certainly was the case here. It was a given that most of the time you would see the men in coats and ties. And of course, along with that for the freshmen was the beanie thing. Dad used to take us down to Doc's Corner Grill, which is now Mountain Copy Graphics. And Doc was, I don't even remember his last name, but Doc was this great old guy who ran the grill, and they served breakfast. And I'm not going to remember her name, but she's the secretary at Maury River Middle School. I think her last name is Alexander, and I'm gonna think it might even be Florence Alexander. I think that's her name. She was a waitress down at Doc's. And we would go down there occasionally for breakfast, because that's when we were going to Ann Smith, which is now the Chi Psi House. God, it just makes me weep every time I think of the Chi Psi's being in that school. I'll get to that later.
I
don't even want to talk
about that.
It just makes me ill to think about it. But at any rate, that was Ann Smith, and we used to go down to Doc's and have breakfast, and it would be fairly early, and we see a lot of guys going to class, and that's what I remember vividly. A lot of the W&O guys going to class, or coming from the post office, or going to class, and you'd see all the freshmen in the beanies and, you know, the coat and tie thing, and it was just I can't imagine any town or any place in the country, certainly any college town, being more typical of reflecting the period that we did. And again, I'm quite sure that the same kind of thing went on at other schools, but ours, it was quintessential period, coat and tie. And of course, then they had the assimilation committee. which is really pretty hilarious when you think about it. It's nothing but a fascist conformist committee, which made sure that everybody was doing pretty much the same thing. And you couldn't be too different then. And that's the downside of what was on the surface, the pretty Norman Rockwell picture postcard kind of image of what a school or a college town was supposed to be like, when in fact there really wasn't very much tolerance. And so the assimilation committee made sure that people wore their coats and ties, and that freshmen wore their beanies, and that things were, you know, people weren't rocking the boat too hard. And you look back on it now and say, my God, how could that, you know, it could exist then, but you couldn't even think of it existing at any school today.
When did the boat start to get rocked?
Oh, the late 60s, when the spillover from UVA and other schools, but I guess there was some agitation from some of the activists at UVA and our own. I mean, Jeff Gingold and others here at W&L were in the middle of the war protest movement. And so it was the late 60s. It was just before I got here, because I can remember friends of mine who were here in, I started in the fall of 70, so those who started in the fall of 69, you know, were just right there in the middle of it. And that's when the school decided, and I can't remember if it was for more than 1 year, but there was a point at which, maybe it was in the spring of 70 or the spring of 69, when they allowed students to take incompletes in order to protest, you know, the war.
It was 1970.
Is that when it was? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the spring
May
of 70.
1970.
Right, okay. Well, it was at that time that, you know, all of these demonstrations were going on, and they had them down in front of the chapel. You know, we had our share, but not nearly to the extent that other schools did. I think we were, depending on how you want to look at it, we were protected, if you want to look at it that way, or insulated by geography, the fact that we were harder to get to than a lot of other places, and we were smaller, and probably, given the nature of Washington and Lee, had fewer people who were interested in agitating against the war, although there was an element within the student body. And I wasn't here then, so in that year, so I've just pretty much heard what people
now,
talk
where were
about.
You?
I was in high school. See, I was class of 74, so I entered in the fall of 70.
Oh, okay.
So I missed that year.
And did you go to high school here in Lexington?
I went to Episcopal High School in Alexandria.
Oh, okay. So you were gone
so
through
I was,
this transitional
I
period.
Was gone in the late 60s. I mean, I was watching it, you know, from within my high school. Uh-huh. Where there was that same concern, and everybody was going through that. And in Washington, we were actually closer to it than a lot of people, because we were right in Alexandria, watching the city burn. I mean, we watched, you know, after Martin Luther King was assassinated, we could literally, Episcopal's on a slightly elevated property, and at the top of some of the buildings, you could actually see the Washington burning. But the story that I've heard, you'll have to get somebody else to recount it. Probably Bob Huntley would be the best, because the story is about Bob and Betty Brubaker. There was a sit-down demonstration in his office. Some of the students came in, and it might have been, you know, I can't remember if it would have been black students or just students protesting the war. But there was an element of that ended up in his office, you know, trying to stage a sit-down strike, and the story that I've always heard is a great one, how Betty, you know, the students came in, and Betty just said, well, how may I help you? And we want to see President Huntley. Well, he'll be in shortly, you know, you won't have a seat, or they had taken a seat on the floor, and Bob came in, stepping over all these guys, you know, and saying, you know, well, you know, how can I help you all? And they're protesting this and that, and they want to call off classes and all this, and he would he just said something like, Betty, can you get these gentlemen something to drink? Or, you know, just very nonchalant, like they just W&L guys treated them in that way, as opposed to saying, no, you know, hell no, get out of here, no, we're not going to do that kind of thing. But it was a you need to get that story from somebody, because it was pretty typical the way WNL would approach something like that.
I actually got it from Gene Perry himself.
Is it Gene? It was the black students then,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, Gene told me the story.
Yeah. Tell me the story. Remind me what it was.
He just said that it went on for a while, just like you're describing.
And then they just
And finally
left.
They said, well, you know, we're not getting
anywhere.
Nobody's paying attention to us. And why were we here?
Yeah.
And they eventually just got up and went.
Disappeared, yeah.
They just totally took the passion out of whatever it was they were there for.
But those were tough times everywhere. I guess we got off a little bit easier than a lot of places.
I need to turn the tape over.